Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, it's given away in the title, really. I'm here to talk of marketing stories, production stories, release story, all those bits and bobs, really, that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. What you've happened upon here is one of my occasional special episodes of the Film Stories podcast, where I bring in a filmmaker and talk about their body of work and talk about the stories behind them. I'm delighted for this episode to have been joined by writer and director Gil Keenan, or Kenan, as I'm about to discuss in the interview you're about to hear. Now, he was in town to talk about his latest film as director, A Boy Called Christmas, which is heading to cinemas and Sky Cinemas, Sky Cinema Channel on the 26th of November 2021, the day this podcast has been released. Also, he's just co-written the latest Ghostbusters film, Ghostbusters Afterlife, directed by Jason Reitman. At the point this interview was being recorded, the whole conversation was being recorded, those two films hadn't come out, but we were in the week of release for Ghostbusters Afterlife. So it was all, I'm going to reference that a little bit, just throughout the conversation that I have with Gil. Furthermore, we talk about a couple of other films that he's done. So his directorial debut was the Oscar-nominated and hugely acclaimed, a really brilliant animated movie, Monster House. So we'll be talking about that. He then moved on to the live-action movie City of Ember, which didn't do as well, and we get into that as well. And at one point in the conversation, we start talking about a film called A Giant. Now, A Giant was a movie that was never made, that he tried, on two occasions, he's nearly got it into production. At one point with Shia LaBeouf in 2011, the Jim Henson Company was involved at some point in that as well. And so he just suddenly comes up in the middle of conversation, and that's basically what we're referring to with that, the big unmade film that he still particularly wants to do. I think that's all you need to know going into this conversation. I really enjoyed doing this one. I hope you enjoy listening to it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play you a clip from A Boy Called Christmas, and then you'll go straight into the chat that I had with Gil.
It's a dangerous journey to Elfell.
Under the moon, past the sleeping giants,
up the pointy mountain.
We'll get there.
I know we will.
Nicholas!
Hold on, Mika!
He's a human. Will he eat us?
Where am I?
There's nothing here.
To see something, you must believe in it. Really believe.
Elfhelm. It's incredible.
I'm going to be honest, kid. I did not see this one working out for us.
What is this?
This is a Christmas party.
It's Cake City?
No idea what this Christmas thing is, but I love it.
Who is that?
I'm Nicholas.
No humans can ever be brought here.
Do not let them escape!
No, we're doomed.
So that was a clip from A Boy Called Christmas, and I am joined on a Film Stories podcast special by its director, Mr. Gil Keenan. Have I pronounced your name correctly? That's
yeah. I also answered to Kenan, but Kenan? Both are yeah.
Okay,
Kenan, but both are sufficient to the other.
Okay, can I call you Mr. Gil? That would probably be safer. I can't possibly.
How about just Gil? Let's just make things informal. Let's get progressive.
I didn't realize this was going to be one of those radical podcasts, but okay, let's go with that. First of all, hello. In what must be, I'm just trying to compress what this must be for you. A 3 weeks of your life, I'm going by UK release dates, not US ones. A 3 weeks of your life that I think if like someone had gone back to the start of your career and told you this was about to happen, would be a bit of a pinch yourself mode. So, I'll let you do all the hard work here, if that's all right. Can you sort of put that into words, what this, like, these two films you've got at the same time means to you?
This is a very extraordinary, unusual moment in my life. As you say accurately, if you had told me this, either at the beginning of my career, when I was a kid and a movie freak, or even like 3 years ago, I would have thought was impossible. But I happen to have, through quirks of the universe, through quirks of pandemic scheduling and rescheduling, yeah, two films that I love and care about that are opening within 5 days of each other in some markets, 1 week of each other in some markets, and actually in a couple of them on the very same day. And those two films are A Boy Called Christmas, which I co-wrote and directed, and Ghostbusters Afterlife, which I co-wrote and executive produced. And it just so happens that both are going to be available to audiences in most of the world in the coming days.
And it's the kind of audiences you're aiming both at as well, I think, is interesting, because these are both big family films to varying degrees.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of a guy who is trying to create in theaters and cinemas the experience that I felt was transformative for myself as a young movie lover, the sort of experiences that made me feel like anything was possible and I could leave the cinema and open my closet and find a tunnel that would lead me to another place and time, or a secret staircase that could open up a whole path of adventure for me, or in a more direct way, you know, if I accidentally dropped a picture frame and found a bit of pirate map hidden away behind it. Those are the sort of experiences that felt to me like kind of bells going off as when I was growing up, and they hooked me. They felt like real stories, and they felt like characters who could actually get hurt on their adventures and could have an emotional experience that wasn't just sugar plums and icing sugar. And that's the kind of story that I'm excited to tell.
I digging back into your past and reading interviews you've given in the past, you've always had story making as part and parcel of you. And I've got that you started, even before you got a Super 8 camera, drawing your own picture books.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Number one, I just think that's important to put out there, because there might be someone listening who just thinks, how do I get in? And it's with a pencil and paper isn't a bad way to start. But also, presumably doing a big Christmas movie is as close to sitting there with your picture books as you've ever got, really. Was this preordained to any degree? Or was this like when you were back like in your teens or something, were you going to make the next big Christmas film?
So I didn't know that Christmas was going to be such an important hook for me until I read Matt Haig's book. And what it reminded me of was that actually Christmas and the idea of the holiday, and specifically of Father Christmas or Santa Claus, is actually something that goes right back to who I am and my identity, because I was born here in London. I lived here until I was three, and then we moved to Tel Aviv, which is not a hotbed of Christmas activity come December. But my parents brought the idea of Father Christmas over with us, and only for me, not my younger brother, who wasn't born in London. And I thought that Christmas, and specifically a gift brought over by Father Christmas, was something that that made me connected to the place I was born, and that was special to me, and that that Father Christmas would make a special dispensation, an extra leg of the journey to come down to bring me a gift. And I remember so clearly that sense of wonder and anticipation on Christmas Eve before I would go to sleep that night. And I'd sort of filed away that experience and until I read Matt's book, and it felt to me like all of a sudden it brought that the clarity of the memory of that experience rushing forward. And I knew that I had a story to tell in this film.
I mean, two things from that. Number one, by the sounds of it, your parents were absolute experts at divide and conquer. If like your younger sibling didn't get any of that, and they saved a few quid each Christmas by like only doing it for you. So I'm taking that.
Brilliant. As my
I'm not sure that was quite the takeaway you were going for. But also, I mean, you've grown up in the same era as cinema as me, and very pure ideas and very, you know, very non-cynical ideas like that seem to have been beaten out of cinema a little bit, in particular over the last 10, 15 years. I mean, can you talk to that a little bit? Because that's the kind of idea, and I love that it's in a film, to be clear, but that's the kind of idea that if you voiced in a meeting, presumably at some point, someone looks at you and just like, well, where's the edge to that? Where's the nasty bit of it? Where's the grey area of that? But actually, you seem to be going quite pure on it.
Well, I think that the way that I access magic and wonder as a film fan and as a filmmaker is through the juxtaposition of the grounded and relatable with the extraordinary or fantastical. And so I think that in order to get closer to the first part of that equation, you do need to strip away some of the modern cynicism or artifice, because I think that sort of snarky or postmodern approach can erode our accessibility to the fantastical. So that's a pragmatic choice, both as a story lover and a storyteller. The other part of it is that I in this case, I was a steward of a particularly fully formed character and world that Matt Haig wrote in his book. And Matt, who's a brilliant storyteller, is able to conjure an emotional reality that works across genre, across age groups, and across various mediums to give readers a sense that he's not holding back a part of the human experience that all of us know to be true. That is the base note that sort of punctuates all the joyous moments that we have in life. And so I guess the those are the two halves of the answer to the question of the sort of tonal reality of this film. One is my own sense of how to create something close to wonder in a film, and also my sense of being honest and faithful to what Matt rendered.
I mean, you're utterly heart on sleeve with that, aren't you? I know this is an audio interview, but your hand was on your heart, as you were saying, half of those words as well. I mean, the precious little doubt that you mean every word of that. I can't be jaded, cynical movie hack today, sadly. You're really beating this out of me, I'm afraid.
Sorry, it's a power, the power of... the power of point of view. It's
unbelievable. It will never catch on. One of the things that struck me right throughout here, because I've been following your career for quite a while, is the number of effective collaborations that you've had. that I interview quite a lot of writers and directors who tend to gravitate towards the same people to work with, which is understandable. But what it's almost like a chameleon-like aspect with you in that the collaborators are very broad. And you, I mean, you've gone everyone from what, Zemeckis and Spielberg to on this one, Ol Parker and Matt Haig. And I just wonder if you can talk to that about what you look for in a collaboration and what you get from them.
Well, look, I think that right back from the time where I was sitting in my room writing storybooks on my own, a story is only as effective as the person you share it with and how it opens up in their imagination. I found that through my community in film school, I started to become a better filmmaker because I was aware in a close-knit way of the people who were watching the stories that I was putting out and how that was playing with them. And that experience grew a thousandfold when I was very lucky with my first real bit of filmmaking work in my life on Monster House to be taken under wing by two of my filmmaking gods, Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis, who took my point of view as a storyteller seriously right from the beginning when most people wouldn't have. And I saw that that belief in my point of view gave me tremendous ability. Yeah. You know, that the faith that they put in what the story that I was telling made me a better filmmaker. And I've gotten energy, as you say, from every one of my collaborations, mostly because there's nothing I enjoy more than talking about story. And it feels to me like the purest form of who I am. And whether that story ends up with audiences or not doesn't really matter. It's a great feeling when it does. But I've had many meaningful relationships in my life that have centered on storytelling that haven't, for one reason or another, ended up in front of audiences and were no less meaningful for it. And I get tremendous energy from that from that community of storytelling. For instance, the other film that I have in my life right now, Ghostbusters Afterlife, was a film that came out of a storytelling friendship. You know, Jason Reitman and I met in 2003 when we were both just breaking out, before our first films were even close to coming to screens, maybe 2004. And both of us found in each other a sort of kinship of storytelling and love, and grew a conversation that naturally ended up as the screenplay for Ghostbusters Afterlife. So the answer to the question is that this is as close to the sort of DNA of who I am as a filmmaker and as a film lover as I can get to, which is that this is not something that is incubated on my own until it's a fully formed concept ready to be shared with the world. It's something that for me is a living organism that gets its strength from the conversations that happen on the way to the screen.
But presumably also as a storyteller and a creative person, you've got the same insecurity and inner fear as the rest of us have when we put something out.
No insecurity here. Sorry,
is that right? That shortchanged this, hasn't it?
No. Yes. Crippled by insecurity, sure.
But there are two ways to deal with it. I found in my life with insecurity. Number one is to tunnel down and just work through it entirely by myself. And I read with Monster House, you have moments where that was put into turnaround, for instance. I think that was DreamWorks originally, wasn't it? And then, I wonder if the collaborations also, beyond what you've said, just give you a rocket fuel through some of the fear as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they sort of become the feather in Dumbo's trunk, right? Because if you have somebody to share the highs and the lows of the process of telling a story, you're not carrying it all on your own shoulders. Although at the end of the day, it's still your responsibility. You know, when you're directing a film and putting it out for an audience, you do carry the weight. And I think that's sort of offset by the energy and joy you get from whether the film connects with an audience or not. So you get, I think, more than you give at the end of the day. But I obviously, like every creative person, find that my best way to manage the terror and the fear and the sort of crippling doubt that goes with the leap off of the abyss of creating is to just keep creating, right? Because that is the only way to fill that massive gulf, yawning, horrifying, screaming black hole that all of us have to face.
So, I mean, I was a movie nerd who just came out of nowhere to Monster House, like I think quite a few of us did at the time. And it was only afterwards I read into it a little bit. Mm. And I mean, from the outside looking in, I just wonder about fragile turning points of careers and just moments. And I just wonder if you can take me into that bit, that little chasm between DreamWorks turning the project around and saying it didn't want it, and then incoming Robert Zemeckis and Amblin, and just what the middle bit of that was, that if you lost your belief in such a terrific project.
Thanks. So it's the chronology is a little different. Broadly, Robert Zemeckis was on board from the very beginning.
Okay.
And his image movers were, so the first conversations I had on this film were with Robert Zemeckis. The DreamWorks side of it actually was sort of, it was a massive roadblock, because there were a few days where the film was properly dead, but Amblin was already a part of the process. It was just about whether this would naturally end up going through DreamWorks, which was the studio that that the principal Amblin partner, Steven Spielberg, had created.
Yep.
And that just could not fit into their vision of a studio where they were working hard at that point to create their own homegrown stories. Not this scrappy, weird story that was being kind of brought in from the side. So when the DreamWorks part of Monster House died, there was a moment where the film had gone into, you know, we were sort of shutting down the art department, and I felt like this ride that I had been on that had been almost too good to be true turned out to be in fact too good to be true. And that I would have to just explain to people that I'd had this moment flying close to the sun, and now I'm back to reality. In that case, as I've encountered several times in my life, I saw extraordinary producing. Both Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg rolled up their sleeves and went to the mat for me, and found a new home in Columbia Pictures and Sony that would allow us to make the film that we were hoping to make. And so I saw both the lows and the highs of the business of filmmaking in that experience.
How many questions about Death Becomes Her did you ask Robert Zemeckis?
My God, I love that movie so much. I mean, I have to say, like, every conversation about Monster House would sort of, by natural sense of shared experience, verge or swerve into conversations about E.T. and Back to the Future and Temple of Doom. These were all tonal analogs that we couldn't help but discuss while making Monster House. And I was just having these out-of-body experiences sitting in a movie theater talking to my two filmmaking heroes about movies that completely shaped my life, just like Ghostbusters did in the similar time period. And so all I can say is that I'm very lucky. I know that I love storytelling, and I think I'm good at telling stories, but yes. I know even more than that, that I happen to be a person who loves storytelling, who is very, very lucky. And I was in the right place in the right time, and you know, twists of the universe allowed me to be in those situations.
I mean, this is genuinely a positive movie podcast, so I'm not deliberately zeroing in on one or two bumps in your career. I'm not trying to.
Like all good stories, you can't have the highs without the lows.
I'm curious the aftermath of City of Ember. that City of Ember found its fan base and was enjoyed. But I just wonder, because I've spoken to a couple of directors who had a film or two go well and then one that underperformed in studio expectations, just in financial terms, and felt they went to movie jail. That's the phrase I've heard lots of times. And again, from the outside looking in, I think we distill filmmakers down sometimes to an IMDb page, and it's only what you've done with a credit that's got a date in brackets at the end. And I just wonder if you can talk about the aftermath of that, because I'm aware that you tried to get your giant project off the ground then and there were things you were trying to get moving. But that 7-8 year period after City of Ember before Poltergeist, could you fill that in a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, City of Ember was a failure. It came out and actually was a really difficult process of putting that film out, because the filming of it was a truly joyous creative experience.
I was going to say, I don't want to interrupt your answer, but clarify, was it a failure to you? Were you?
I will clarify it.
Thank you. Yeah.
So City of Ember was a joyous creative experience for me in the making, but went through a pretty extraordinary set of challenges in the finaling of the film, in that the studio that I had been making the film for was liquidated.
Yeah.
This concept of Fox Walden, all of that, before I had even shown a first cut of my film to the executives, most of the executives were fired and disbanded. And so I ended up having to screen my film for a lawyer that was sort of in receivership of the studio. And that's who I was getting notes from. And it was the film was ultimately sort of relegated to a sort of scrap heap of a release. It was not marketed. It was under-released. It was the score had been thrown out and a new one hastily put in just a few weeks. All of that sort of happening in spite of my own attempts kind of keep it on its own track. So for all of the people who were listening to the Monster House part of this conversation saying, screw this guy and his good luck, I ended up having the other side of that coin. I had an experience where I had put all of my best creative feet forward and circumstances, some that I could control and many others that I couldn't, took the film down a different path. And what that meant was that I ended up with a film that I still have tremendous love for because of the cast that I made it with and because a lot of the creative elements that came into the creation of that film, including a relationship with Bill Murray that has remained, and with Saoirse, both of which I you know, and Toby Jones, of course, who I continue to work with.
Yep.
And all of them I dearly love. And all of that came from a really joyous on-set experience. It was something that hurt. I was crushed when the film was sort of dribbled out into cinemas, and because the film had been compromised, was not sort of representing the vision that I had hoped for. And it took having a partner and my wife who really supported me and understood that that it was a moment where I really needed support, not just as an artist, but as a human being.
Yeah.
And then it took discovering a new story that I could put my passion into that ended up being a giant. And actually the process of writing that was extremely therapeutic for me, because I was able to put heart and soul and passion into it. And even though it was a struggle to get made and still hasn't happened, the screenplay and the process of making that was pretty universally loved by the people who read it. And I was able to sort of rediscover faith in my own ability to tell a story, and knew that I had more stories to tell. So it was a dark period. It was very difficult for me as somebody who had tremendous early success, because I was very young when Monster House was greenlit and released and
Oscar nominated, of course.
And Oscar nominated. All of that happened, you know, in my 20s. And so it felt like this was now part of growing up, both as a person and as a filmmaker. And I learned so much from both sides of that experience that I don't see it ultimately as a failure in my life. Yeah. I see it as a sort of stepping stone into the person and filmmaker that I am now. And I think I make better choices now, both as a filmmaker about who I work with, the protections that I make sure are in place creatively so that I don't enter into a process that is going to be creatively compromised, or at least every best intention to make sure I don't enter into that. All of that, I think, has been actually very healthy to, and has allowed me to get to a place where now I have A Boy Called Christmas and Ghostbusters Afterlife coming out within a few days.
Not a bad week, is it?
It's not. Well, we'll see. Ask me in a couple of weeks.
Well, I heard this again from a couple of filmmakers, so I'm going to turn it to you if that's okay. There is a working theory I hear that once the initial release of a film has gone, that after, say, a period of 6 months, whenever anyone comes and talks to you about a film, it's good. That no one outside of that initial release period will come to you afterwards and say anything negative, because it's only been found by people who see the good in it. Can you relate to that at all? Have you found that with your work?
I have to think about that. I feel like, most people, unless they're writing into the vacuum of Twitter or their press writing to their own readers, generally try to avoid coming to a person with their own dislike of that person's work.
Yes.
So I think, but we can't help but be aware, of course, of the spectrum of reactions to a piece of work. I think that it's probably true. I think that you do end up getting mostly positive reinforcement, but I also think that as artists, you have to be sensitive, and being sensitive means being aware. And so that means that you shouldn't be living in a fantasy world where something that didn't connect, you go merrily down the street whistling, feeling like you had slam dunked another one. And I think it's important to know when your audience feels like they've been catered to, or when they feel like they've been missed. And that's just part of the process.
And I'm guessing the whole experience on Poltergeist of Sam Raimi reaching out to you was, to the movie nerd when you were growing up, that was just, I don't know how you even get a communication from Sam Raimi and stay vaguely grounded. But I mean, Poltergeist was 2015. Our first I remember of A Boy Called Christmas was, I think, Ol Parker was signed up to adapt the script. That was back 2016. So these seem quite close together. Can you take me into that period a little bit, please?
Yeah. So I don't know exactly what the process was between Ol's engagement and when the material was sent to me, sort of around Christmas of 2017. Yeah. But probably Ol had been writing his adaptation, which was a wonderful adaptation that was sent to me with with Matt Haig's novel by the producer Graham Broadbent, strategically about a week before Christmas of that year.
Nice.
And so I actually decided not to fall for that trap, and I didn't read it until the first week in January, just because I didn't want to be swayed. I'm no sucker. So I started a wonderful conversation with Ol that led to our collaboration. And then he went off to direct the Mamma Mia script that he had written. And I still had about a year of development and pre-production on A Boy Called Christmas, and sort of just picked up the pen and kept going. The period of time, it felt like a really rich period because I had been working with Jason Reitman throughout just after the Poltergeist release. We began a collaboration on two screenplays before we started writing Ghostbusters Afterlife. And so, I felt like, okay, I was becoming more and more confident in my ability to put my name on a screenplay. And it, because I had been doing lots of writing, of course, A Giant I had written on my own, but that was for me an extraordinary experience, because up until that point, I had just been doing the sort of writing work that is expected of a director. And it felt like, okay, the storytelling part of me is becoming more confident.
We've just got a few minutes left, and so I want to come to it. We have to end with A Boy Called Christmas, primarily because it's the reason we're here as well. We started there, we'll end there. But the cliche for us on the outside is, if you're shooting a Christmas movie, you do it in the middle of summer, where it's absolutely sweltering and everything. So first of all, can you affirm that happened?
I mean, it was a long shoot, but I have to say that it started in the North Pole. I mean, we started north of the Arctic Circle in the absolute dead of winter. So so I paid my dues.
You didn't get the memo, did you?
I paid my weather dues. But the final weeks of filming were ended up in Prague in the Czech Republic, and there were scenes with snow on the ground that were properly sweltering. So we had it all, you know, we had the full scope. It was a weather buffet.
So you've ruined the IMDb trivia section for your movie, which has to have something about how you had to import snow from like the other part of the world or something like that. I love how much you commit to this. I mean, I've followed your filmmaking for a long time. This seems like what is it? Four different countries you shot in. It just seems like the biggest movie as a director you've taken on by some distance. Take me to the human being at the heart of that, with relation to that boy who was writing picture books all that time ago.
It's pure storytelling. It's the belief in me that the producers and studios showed, that I said, I think we should actually start this film north of the Arctic Circle. I think we should show the audience that what this reality is like, what the snow feels like, what the mountains look like, what the light is. And that they sort of just nodded and said, sure, let's figure that out. The fact that I was able to bring a cast and crew up to the top of a mountain in Slovakia that could only be accessed by snowmobile through a snowstorm with a sort of jerry-rigged camera moving system that allowed me to have the sort of freedom of movement that I wanted on scenes, to the willingness to allow Gary Williamson, my brilliant production designer, to properly build out an entire city out of wood and sweat and tears in the back lot of Berendorf Film Studio in Prague. All of that just felt like I felt the direct line between the drawings I used to make in those picture books when I was young to the sort of filmmaker that I hope I've graduated to, which is that if I can imagine it, then I can put it on screen. And that's not something that you easily arrive at. I think it takes support, both of the people you enter into a venture of storytelling with, and also the many, many artists whose work is what gives soul to this story.
I know these conversations are supposed to end with the question of what you're up to next, and then we do the dance of what you can tell me and what you can't tell me. So I'm going the other way. Can you tell me a story of working with Dame Maggie Smith and Toby Jones, please?
Oh yeah, well, with Toby, Toby is like my filmmaking good luck charm. I mean, I got along so well with Toby on City of Ember that we began a conversation that never ended, and so we still. He's such a gift as a human and as an artist, and I find I get so much energy from working with him. One thing I'll say about Toby that I didn't know before we made this film is that he is a phenomenal dancer, and there is a dance sequence that killed me that I had to remove from this film where he gives one of the great dancing, I mean, up there with like Travolta in Pulp Fiction, like an absolute world-class bit of cinema dancing. And it just did not fit into the shape of the film as I was building it. And it was a gutting moment for me as a filmmaker. That's your Toby Jones story. And with Maggie, I was terrified of working with her, and I didn't know how it was going to work out. And Grant Broadbent, the producer, brilliantly suggested that she and I go to lunch together first, just to meet as people. Yeah. And we had the most wonderful first date where we went to a beautiful restaurant. We talked for hours, and then we wandered through the streets of Chelsea and picked up flowers along the way. And at the end, I photographed her, and it felt like that photograph was me sort of getting access to who she is beyond the legend. And I felt like through the ability, the vulnerability of allowing me to take a portrait of her, I was given access, and I just feel so grateful.
I love the humanity of your stories, and I love the passion with which you tell them. And and I sat and watched A Boy Called Christmas with my kids. I saved this bit till the end, and what a joy. What a joy.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Huge congratulations to you. And thank you so much. I'm going for it. Gil Kenan.
Right. Yeah, all right, nailed it.
Thank you very much for your time, and congratulations on your amazing week or two.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Simon. Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Gil Kenan, as I now correctly pronounce it, covering A Boy Called Christmas, which is on Sky Cinema and in cinemas at the point this podcast is being released. And also Ghostbusters Afterlife is playing in cinemas around the world too. If you want more of my waffle going forward, you can find me on Twitter at Simon Brew. You can find the entire Film Stories project at Film Stories Pod. Website filmstories.co.uk, updated every weekday with movie news, mayhem review, all sorts of bits and bobs there. And the Film Stories shop at store.filmstories.co.uk has back issues of our magazines, has our sneakers, Blu-ray and bits and bobs as well. At Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. And if you want to support this podcast, you can find more at patreon.com/SimonBrew, where you get podcasts early, all sorts of bits and gossip and things like that. But without further ado, I'm going to thank you very much for your time, and I'm going to leave you in peace. I'll be back soon with your regular episode of Film Stories. Until then, you all take care and look after yourselves. Bye bye.